In a new art show at the Kansas City Public Library, a flimsy sheet of glittery fabric is tacked right onto the wall over a baby picture, like a veil or a mask. The baby has dark hair and plays with a bright blue toy phone, and scrawled beside the image are the words, "Mi vida loca," my crazy life. This is just one detail from one work of art in a show by Rodolfo Marone called This Is for La Raza. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCOR Central Standard. And the last time we talked to Rodolfo, he was right on the cusp of recognition in the local art scene. Now, just a year and a half later, he's entered the national arena through residencies and awards. So we want to hear what's changed for him, what he's exploring now in his crazy life that he might not have been ready to take on just a short time ago. Rodolfo, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I heard you were in kind of a scary car accident, and I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah, I'm a trooper. As they say, I'm a Mexican, so I gotta make it happen.
What has changed for you in a bigger sense? And then we'll drill down into some specifics like materials and that kind of thing.
Sure. I think last time I was here, I was talking about the Charlotte Street Award that I think I had just received.
Yeah.
And also like this natural materials that I was using. And during that time, or shortly afterwards, my work kind of took this drastic change, and the work really became about identity, whether it was being Mexican-American, Chicano, Latinx, queer. And I think the materials...
Aspects of your own identity.
Yeah. And the materials were definitely informed by that. It was, I think you guys did an article where it was like the artist that uses weeds to wonder, something pretty sounding like that.
Yeah, because, okay, so to catch people up, you were grinding down pigments from, like, local berries growing on the side of the road, stuff like that, using a mortar and pestle. And that is, I did get the idea from going to that show I talked about, just looking at it, that's not what was going on here entirely.
No, ma'am. Now I've just kind of gone the opposite way, and I've just tacked on a bunch of iridescent, flashy materials like sequin, tinsel, glitter.
But you do use something that we think of as food.
Oh, right. That's going to be my claim to fame, hopefully. It's the, I've started using Cheetos Flamin' Hots. And that's also kind of come from this idea of wanting to call back to my childhood and kind of going to the local Mexican corner store and getting like some hot chips and kind of thinking about what the berries were doing to my fingers and how that was sort of staining them, and thinking about this snack that I've always kind of grown up enjoying and eating, and how that kind of did something similar. This last past year and a half, it's been a great adventure in just kind of really diving in and exploring language, imagery, sort of like my roots, my raíces.
How have your experiences going to the residencies you've done, has that informed your desire to explore your own identity more directly?
Oh, for sure. It's created a monster.
Tell me more about that. Tell me about the experiences and what's changed for you as a person that is translating into these changes into your art.
Sure. I did a residency in upstate New York called Art Omai. It's predominantly an international arts residency. So there was...
A very prestigious one.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. There were 27 artists that represented 27 other countries and 3 artists from the United States. And I was one of them. But I felt like I represented something more specific, being like a child of an immigrant, being first generation Mexican-American. So I was definitely sort of pushing that. And for the most part, I just existed in the Midwest with my artwork and sort of my audience. And
Before the residency.
Correct. So I was really interested in seeing how could I further push this dialogue of being Latinx, of being Chicano, and how that would translate and how could that be picked up by a larger audience.
And also, it sounds like really, if all of these artists are coming from different countries, they're kind of also representing those countries. So it sounds to me like you are also probably dealing with how does that represent what it means to be American.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. We went to Francis Greenberg, who's he started Art Omai, and he invited us to his house for 4th of July. And so all these international artists were asking me, how do I celebrate 4th of July, or how do you do that? What do you wear? And I was like, I don't know. It's like, I know how we did it like growing up, but that's a completely different experience than I guess the everyday Anglo-American living here in the United States or living here in the Midwest.
Tell me how you celebrated the 4th of July.
You know,
as a kid.
Carne asada, maybe some gunshots into the air because that's what they do. And it's just more, you know, it's just more of an interjection of like spice. We're just going to say that.
Well, I guess, but you didn't feel like that was a legit answer to how you celebrate the 4th of July?
I guess. I also didn't want to be the spokesperson for like the American man because I felt like I don't maybe perhaps fit within the parameters of what individuals might think of what this American boy might be. I'm a lot more effeminate. I'm a little bit odd and just kind of do things differently. I'm a counterculturalist or something of that nature. So I kind of, I don't know, I just like to mess around as well. So I didn't want to give them a false idea, but I wanted to show them something more representative of the different dynamic personalities that exist here.
You also did a residency on Fire Island, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that one.
Well, as I guess I got a little off track. With both residencies, it really sort of allowed me to look at a larger audience and to kind of look at these groups of people that would sort of really identify with the work by having, you know, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Latino artists sort of look at my work and kind of get it and immediately understand. Just because I was coming at it from a Chicano standpoint, it was still received and understood by this much broader sort of identity of being Latino. And with Fire Island, it's the only LGBTQ artist residency in the country or world. And so that was another way to sort of explore this idea of my queer identity and to kind of just find other like-minded individuals and kind of how the work that I'm creating isn't overtly queer, but it has that sensibility through the materials that I use and this idea of like ritual and practice and this sort of more delicate sort of approach to it.
Can you explain that a little more? I mean, what was it? It sounds, am I misunderstanding? It sounds like you also partly realized that that was in your work in a way that you hadn't maybe seen before.
Yeah. I had contemplated applying to Fire 2 years prior, but I didn't, due to that nature of thinking like, oh, is this work gay enough? Is this like, does it have to have this like larger connotation of something, you know, queer? But then I kind of rationalized and realized that it just works because the person that's creating the work, it so happens to be that. And through the different sort of applications that I started using, like I started sewing on sequin, something that was fairly new and relevant to me, but something that could be seen as much more effeminate. And I think coming from sort of the Latin community, which is a lot more machismo-based, even just like sewing on and being attracted to these more delicate and softer objects and materials, I think kind of just immediately makes it that.
It's interesting to me that you've more directly embraced the idea of yourself as, I guess, a Latino artist who has something to say about that experience really overtly. And also this other experience of being, you know, the term that you seem to gravitate toward, queer, that with that machismo idea, that those are interesting currents to be exploring at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there's this term of Latinx that's been going around for some time now, and it kind of eliminates the female and male pronouns.
So instead of Latina, Latino.
Correct. And I've even adopted that or used that when I'm talking about like my Chicano. So sometimes I'll say Chicanx, and it's honestly an exploration of sort of myself and the times. I felt like the work that I was creating before dealt with this fantasy made up world, and just through personal life experiences with family and kind of politically what was happening, I felt like I needed to get out of that made up world and kind of live in something more real. And I think that's what really called me to look at my family, look at my sister Silvia, my brother David, and to try to call back to them and to bring them closer to me during a time that felt I was becoming more distant to them, just due to the nature of sort of what has happened. And just to find community. I think that's something that has become really important, is to find community, especially here in Kansas City, especially living in the Midwest, and finding other artists of color and other queer artists, and really kind of creating this camaraderie and this safe space and opportunity to just kind of be together and understand each other, language and imagery, religion, or spiritual practice has become important.
Tell me more about your brother and sister and that distance, because I want to get into some of the images I saw in that art show I was sure. describing earlier, but I think we might understand them better if we know a little bit about your family, because family photos are a big part of that exhibit.
Yeah, that's the other component that became more prevalent in my work, is that I started using photographs, and specifically family photographs. And so I'm opening I'm in a group exhibition coming up here at the Bemis in Omaha, and that's called, the show is called Monarch. And I wanted to talk about specifically like my mother's story immigrating here during the 70s, and then my brother being deported during 2007. So in that sense, like, that's why I use those sort of images, because they are kind of talking about a larger sort of...
Why was your brother deported? Can you tell us that story?
I'll just go ahead and say life decisions, just because I think it doesn't take that much, if you're undocumented, it doesn't take that much to kind of just be thrown back where you came from. You could just be driving down the highway, and if a cop wants to like mess with you and wants to send you back, that's all that's needed. But This Is For La Raza here in Kansas City kind of talks a little bit about that very subversely, and just kind of like the gang or Cholo culture that's kind of also intertwined with the Chicano culture through the imagery, the language.
Wait, what is that? Can you talk to me?
Well, like certain phrases. So like there's a language in Chicano culture called Galo. And so that's just where a lot of like kind of phrases come from that I grew up using.
Phrases like la raza?
Raza just means like your race, your kind, your people, your tribe. There's also, I guess, a lot of the terms are also like fairly like jabs or a little like negative. So I've kind of also... Chavala. Chavala is like a term to use for girl, but it also means like punk, or another word that starts with a P. And so... it's just like language that's a little harsh and abrasive, but here I am sort of using it and kind of writing it in glitter and kind of contrasting that with the images, contrasting that with this iridescence, with the Cheetos residue kind of burning into the paper, scratching away at the photograph. So there are these really kind of, for me, interesting moments and very tactile moments that are happening in the process that kind of really further inform what's happening.
So... one of the things that comes up a lot in the works in this exhibit, This Is For La Raza, there are photographs, and then they have different materials over them with the eyes cut out so that they're sort of like masks over mm-hmm. the people in the photographs. And you don't cover the photographs underneath all the way. I mean, you make it sort of very tempting to get close and try to look under the mask and... you don't try to make it polished and perfect. You try to make it really obvious that this is just one piece of paper or fabric or something layered over an image. Mm-hmm. What are you doing there?
Well, that started during my exhibition at the Kemper. And I think for me, that was a way to kind of give the viewer just enough of my family. Or to sort of shroud and mask these figures so that perhaps they could project and sort of imagine whoever they thought was behind there. But it was also a way for me to sort of keep them for myself. Like, I would never give the full untouched photo of my mother to the viewer, because that's mine. That's for me to hold. That's for me to have. And same for the photos of my sister Silvia and my brother Adolfo and my brother Chico. Like, it's still a way for me to hold on to them and to kind of protect them. But it, But by veiling them, it kind of gives them this otherworldly sense that they can sort of transcend beyond what those photos are. And in a way, I always thought like I'm sanctifying them just for being like who they are, just for being a sister and a mother and a brother who's been deported, that there's this like larger sort of message that can be brought through the materials or the sentiment behind it.
So talk to me about those specific photographs you chose. There are photographs at what looks like a birthday party. There's this photograph of a baby playing with a toy phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the main image that I use for this, for La Raza, has a photo of my brother sort of veiled in this sort of gold glitter. And then in it, I sort of started chipping away at it and kind of wrote puro, which means pure. And then at the top of it, it says mala suerte, which means bad luck. But that piece was really kind of indicative about any young brown man that has been murdered. It could have been through gang violence. It could have been through police brutality, what have you. But for me, that was the larger story of it's looking at like my like family or just these figures and thinking about how lucky they are. Or how unfortunate it is sometimes to lose a son to these senseless acts of violence. And so by masking my brother, by using my brother and thinking how he's now, you know, he's calmed down, he's settled down, he has his kids and he's working. He works very hard. And how just
in
like...
In Mexico?
No,
this is the other brother.
Or it can be anyone. It could be either one. But just definitely that transformation that happens. And so by veiling him, it kind of once again took away that immediate identity. And it could be anyone. It was a way to sort of mourn a larger idea of these young men that have passed away.
The idea of whether people are being mourned or celebrated or protected... it is interesting with the particular fabrics you choose. I mean, veiling is kind of a way of protecting, mm-hmm. but that, yeah, it's sequins and glitter and you've talked about that being a part of your identity, but how is that a part of what you're trying to say about really events ranging from deportation to murder?
Because it's me, because I'm the one that's creating it. And I think through that, sensitivity, that sort of being attracted to something more effeminate or flashy, that's just like who I was as a kid, and just that's how I learned how to maneuver through the world, was just trusting that sensitivity and being more attracted to these things. And so I think it's just my ability as an artist to just interject that and to sort of own that, like with those images and with those topics. It's also a way to allow the viewer to perhaps get a little closer to the sort of underlying issue and not be hit over the head, because you're seeing something that's really, like, I guess aesthetically pleasing because it's reflective and it's shiny and from a distance. And as you get closer, perhaps you start seeing something a little bit more different, or you start noticing that that is a photo of a child, or that there is this phrase sort of inscribed next to it.
You do have to get really close to, because they aren't enlarged photos, and they... the handwriting that you've put next to them is very small. You do ask people to come to a very intimate place with these things before you veil them and cover them up. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic, like come close, but not all the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's another theme that I've sort of been playing with, is like these ideas of altars and or home altars. And so even... like thinking about the color of the walls and how that references...
It's bright turquoise.
Yeah, that's like the color of the walls of my house growing up. But I amped it up a bit for the gallery space. But it still like calls back to that sort of safe space, this sort of domestic place that can feel comfortable. And so once again, I think like that with the materials, the works on paper, the family photographs, and these recognizable images within Chicano or Latino culture, I think that's kind of what might help for that community to kind of start seeing themselves in some of this work, and to kind of start seeing the art world, something that's more approachable for them.
There's another, these images are all just sort of like, they're objects that are collected and displayed together in kind of these constellations. You mentioned that you were partly referring to like altars, and that's definitely what they feel like. There's one where the centerpiece is a dusty bathroom mirror, and you can see smudged lines in the dust that mm-hmm. look like they're made with an index finger, and they form a cross. And to feel like you're looking in someone else's mirror with the traces of their finger in it, that is also just an incredibly intimate, that is an incredibly intimate thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of myself is literally going into the work just from like, because I eat the hot Cheetos. I don't waste them. I was raised right.
We're going to get right back to these Cheetos.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just that like to actually show the print of myself in it, but also to have it be a moment of reflection for the viewer as well. So mirrors have become a important part in the way that I also like to sort of, or something that I like to interject into these altars or shrines so that you're looking back and just kind of reacting to the space as well, or what feels good.
You see yourself in someone else's life. I mean, very literally.
Yeah. I'm definitely trying to channel a little brujeria, a little something witchy as well into it, because that is another movement that's happening right now. And it's sort of claiming.
Wait, tell me about that.
Well, it's just like kind of, I think for myself, the way I've taken it is to kind of claim some sort of spirituality for myself that is furthering itself from perhaps what I was raised with, which was Catholicism. So, I mean, there's a lot of Catholic imagery, but I'm adding these small nuances to those pre-existing images and creating something different. Like I had a little baby Jesus figure and I adhered a cicada wing onto its face and then added like a lucky rabbit's foot sort of hanging above him. And so that kind of really elevated and took this figure of, you know, Christ as a child and kind of, I don't know, I kind of created something a little bit more mystic just for myself, just through the materials that I'm attracted to and how those are represented.
You talked about increasing distance with your brother and sister and that your upcoming show at the Bemis, as well as this local show at the Kansas City Public Library, you're trying to bring them closer to you in a way. And do you feel closer to your brother and sister?
Yeah, definitely. Like for this exhibition at the Bemis.
Which is a very well-known, I mean, this is, I need to say for people who don't really follow art, this is not a community center in another city or an underground gallery. This is the real deal. This is like their Nelson or Kemper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, go on.
But for that show, I think I started talking a little bit about it earlier. But with that, I am talking about my mother being from Michoacán, Caracuaro, Michoacán, and my brother also being from
a region in Mexico.
Yeah, and my brother also being from Caracuaro, Michoacán, which is where the monarchs go and migrate. And so through that, I kind of wanted to blend sort of my mother's story and his story together. But through that, I've been able to kind of have these conversations with her and figuring out like when she immigrated here, talking to my brother Chico and sort of figuring out just like talking to him. Like we were on the phone and he was telling me he named his son Rudy. And so he was telling me how he has to look out for little Rudy, that there's scorpions around, and that, you know, he lives in this very rural part of town, so that if he's not careful, and if little Rudy gets stung by a scorpion, you know, it's just this worrisome. And I think about, like, this real danger that he now sort of has to, or this different world that he now exists in versus, you know, originally being here with all his family in Kansas City. And so through that, I even found, like, a scorpion. My brother Adolfo collects weird like animals now and just has like a ton of turtles, but he had a scorpion and it got loose and it shed its skin and my mother found it. So I took like that scorpion, the like what it sort of shed, and I put that into like the art show just from having that conversation with Chico and this sort of fear. You know, you think about this danger, this poison, this sort of I don't know, something threatening, and that need to sort of survive. And perhaps what was, you know, what did he do as a younger man in order to survive, or at least in when he was living in California or here in Kansas City, and sort of the decisions that you make that evidently lead you to, you know, have the life that you have and, you know, having to deal with those consequences.
What is your favorite work of art in display in your show at the library right now?
I think it's the one of my sister Sylvia. It's a piece of pink wallpaper, and I burned onto it in Old English, "Angel Baby," and thinking about the song. I forget the artist who sang that, but that's like my family. They grew up listening to like Motown and oldies, and so that's I guess like also a very Chicano thing. And so that kind of like brings me back to my sister and thinking about like those like during the early 90s. So I covered my sister up and put this phrase on it. And then I have these two smaller photos of her on the side playing with my cousin, Jeannie. And then I think she's riding like a big wheel in one of them. And then it's kind of, I don't know, there's just something about the simplicity and the symmetry of it that looks really great. And then I've tacked on these like wax flowers as like a little motif underneath with like this gold tinsel that just starts to like drip down. So there's like this undulating energy that eventually just hits the floor and sits there.
We have not really addressed the Cheetos Flamin' Hots. And before we go, I do want you to explain the role those had in your childhood and how you use them now.
Yeah, I mean, I just love spicy food. I mean, yeah. As I was kind of working with the material, I mean, my nephews and nieces, they eat, Takis and Cheetos, and they're like 2, 3, 4 years old. And so kind of just as I started to look around and go into Quick Trip, I would notice that predominantly the individuals that would buy, these snacks were like young children of color. And I was like, okay, like maybe a lot of like Black and brown folks just love this for the spice, but I just it's always been something that I've like recognized in that in those communities that is just abundantly ingested, and I love them to death.
How will people see this snack in your art?
I have the sort of powder, the residue on my fingers, and so I'm literally like pressing my thumbs and fingers into it.
You can see This Is for La Raza by Rodolfo Marone III at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library through the end of the year. Walk all the way back to the gallery on the first floor, and you will see the bright turquoise walls. Thank you, Rodolfo.
Thank you so very much.
Up next, the history of race and African Americans in Liberty, Missouri. And for what it's worth, this may not be the story you're expecting to hear. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now the story of a long-standing African-American community in Liberty, Missouri, and the people who are trying to get that history out of the margins and into the mainstream of what we know about ourselves and our past in this region. A.J. Bird is president of the Clay County African-American Legacy, and his own family is a part of this story. Good morning, A.J.
Good morning.
So I'd like you to start by telling me about your great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather, John Jack Houston, and most called him Jack Houston, came to Missouri, to Clay County, to Liberty in 1843 as a free man.
Where did he come from?
He came from somewhere in Kentucky. We're still doing some research. As a matter of fact, I was recently in Cincinnati at the National Underground Railroad Museum, and they've agreed to assist me in tracing some of my family history, not only just on my grandfather's side, but also his wife's. But he came to Liberty in 1843 as a free man, but he had to go back and purchase his wife's freedom. And by the time he went back after her, she was actually in Sandusky, Ohio. So I don't know the relationship, but somehow he had to make a purchase. And then he brought her to Liberty, where he worked on a farm, the Withers Farm, as a free man, but earned money to buy his own land there in Liberty. And one of the questions, if I can share this with you,
yeah.
I asked my mother, I said, why would he, being a free man, he's in Ohio, why would he come to Missouri, a slave state?
Yeah, that's
and,
a good question.
And she shared with me that, well, as she understood it, basically the land in Ohio was so expensive and already taken, and Missouri was just opening up, especially the western part of the state. And so the opportunity for land was there, and of course, being an agrarian society, everything revolved around the land. And so So obviously he came in some difficult circumstances as reason to gain land, which he did after being there several years.
What do you know about this? Is just a kind of character from the past that I haven't heard about a lot. What do you know about the rights of a free man who is African-American in a slave state during the time of slavery? You know what I mean?
Well, I do know this much, is that he there were times when he had some had paperwork that related to show his freedom. But as he became acquainted with citizens and people in Liberty, they built relationships and they knew him. And his relationship with the Withers family apparently created a situation where he could move about the town as he became more familiar with people. And there was one other piece that I think made it very important. He could read and write. His wife, Elvira, had taught him to read and write when they were on the plantation years before that. So with that in mind, you know, he had some understanding of that. And so he negotiated his way around, and knowing my family, they knew how to hold a conversation. And so he apparently, he was a voter once he was set, once African-Americans were freed, he voted after 1865 and continued to vote most of his life.
And he started a church.
He was involved in starting a church. He was one of the members for the First Baptist Church of Liberty, which was started shortly after in 1843. And he was a member that about six or seven members who started that church were African-Americans. Yes. Actually, they fellowshipped and worshiped with their white counterparts at the courthouse, Clay County Courthouse in Liberty, prior to moving to a livery stable on the street over on what was called Gallatin Street, and ultimately moved to several other locations before they actually established the physical presence of the First Baptist Church.
The way that you tell your great-grandfather's story, it sounds like maybe it could just be an anomaly, but when you talk about six or seven people getting together and starting a church, six or seven is way beyond coincidence and anomaly.
Share with me what you're asking me again.
Well, what do you know about like the larger community your great-grandfather was part of, this African-American community in Liberty?
Well, I think there were more members in that, or members of the church, but these were the church leaders, mm-hmm. and my grandfather happened to be one of those. So there were more than six people that formed this church. I don't know the exact number, but it was more than him. But he was one of the leaders, I think, who served as a deacon in the church.
Can you tell me what your great-grandfather's story says about Liberty and Clay County in the 19th century, early 20th century, that we might not generally be so aware of?
For lack of a better expression, it's a paradox in many ways. Here, my grandfather had some very close relationships with the Withers family. Although when I look at the history, and you look at our country's history, you see sometimes these relationships, these bonds that develop between, even though my grandfather was a free man, he was still a second-class citizen in this country. You see that here there was these relationships on a certain area where they had common bonds and commonality and a natural kind of interactions as human beings would have. But then you had this larger situation, an umbrella, that said you can't go to these places. You can't fellowship if you're fellowshipping. I picture my grandfather there being at the service in the courthouse in the back of wherever the worship was taking place. I shared with you just a minute ago that my grandfather wasn't able to vote, even though he was a free man. And I also shared what he had to carry some kind of papers with him. So you had this conflict going on. And let me be candid with you. To some extent, we see that even yet today.
Can you talk to me about education and race in this period of Liberty's history?
Right, I can. As I shared with you, my grandfather and his wife, Elvira, my great-grandfather, both could read, but their son, Charles Houston, my immediate grandfather, also, and I just confirmed this recently with my mom going over some things as I talked to Dr. Robinson. My grandfather completed the eighth grade, Charlie Houston, and he attended at what was being St. Luke's AME Church. And that would have to have been after 1875, because I believe that was when that church was established. And he completed the eighth grade. Well, in that time, in the 19th century, an eighth grade education was relatively standard. So it suggests to me that there was some support there from the large community supporting education. Just as I also shared with you about my great-grandfather voting. So yes, education has always been vital. I think when I learned, when my uncle shared with me about my grandfather could read, I became keenly aware as why education had been emphasized so much in my family history. And our family has sought to aspire to be well educated as possible in order to compete and meet challenges in this world. So I would say that education has always been vital and it's paid dividends. I think it's one of the reasons why my great grandfather was able to purchase land and keep it because he could read and write.
I want to turn to someone else now because the education piece of this is actually taking on a new life in a couple of murals that were just unveiled last month. For more on that, I want to turn to Cecilia A. Robinson. She's a historian who is also with us from Clay County African American Legacy. Cecilia, hello.
How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
Fine.
Tell me about these new murals.
We have two murals that were dedicated a couple of weeks ago at Garrison. And they tell the story from segregation to integration. And the images that are on both of the murals, the first mural, we have one on the Water Street side of the building. And it has on it the very first African-American school that was in Clay County in 1865. You know, prior to 1865, it was against the law to teach African-Americans to read and write. And so at the end of the 1865, Laura Armstrong opened a school, a subscription school where you pay $2 in her home and had a few students there. That was the first one. Then there was another school by Lucretia Robinson, and then one by an African-American man by the name of Nathan Berry. And then finally, during Reconstruction in 1877, then we have Garrison School. And so Garrison is the school that was established in 1877. And we have pictures.
And the first one that's outside of a home?
Yes, it's the first, the one outside of the home came after about 1867.
What do these murals and this story of education and race in Clay County, what do they mean to you? I mean, what do you want people to know about this?
When you see Garrison School, the last standing African-American segregated school in Clay County, when you see that, what you actually see is history that began with Plessy versus Ferguson, with separate but equal schools. And when 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, when the Supreme Court ruled that separate schools were unequal, it represents for us the change that came across the nation for all students who were attending African American schools or segregated schools.
We'll hear more on that in just a minute. And we will get back to this conversation about the history of the African-American community in Liberty, Missouri, and the surrounding Clay County in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR Central Standard. I've been talking with Cecilia A. Robinson and A.J. Bird from Clay County African American Legacy. Cecilia is a historian, and A.J. is the organization's president. His family helped found the First Baptist Church in Liberty in 1843, and we're hearing about the community his great-grandfather and others were part of. We were just talking about two new murals in Liberty that depict the history of education and integration versus segregation in Clay County, which is a really interesting history, that there's this Garrison School that has a profound history. And Cecilia, pick up where you left off.
All right. The school itself, as I said, it was segregated. But at the end of, in 1954, after Brown versus Board of Education, they had to integrate, the court said, with all deliberate speed. Liberty did integrate somewhat with all deliberate speed compared to schools across the nation that were separate and unequal. Those schools did not actually integrate until almost 25 years later.
Yeah, and there's a lot of foot dragging / yes. National Guard presence yes. for a lot of those events.
Right, because it was left up to the cities, the states to decide, not cities, but states to decide when and how. That was a gray area. When you say with all deliberate speed, you could work through that for years.
This
I know
is as fast
that,
as I can go.
As fast as I can go, because I know I graduated from high school and in the 60s, and my school was still totally African American. However, in Liberty, the schools were integrated.
What was that moment of integration like in Liberty? Was it contested? And I mean, because you hear stories in major cities across the South that were violent.
Well, Albert would be the one could tell you more about that, so because he was here at the time.
I also have a given name, Albert.
I'm sorry. Share this.
That's quite all right. I answer to both. I was a fifth grader at Garrison School, attended Garrison School for 5 years, and so had been in that situation when the notice was given that schools were going to be integrated. And as I recall, my parents, they went to meetings. There were some discussions taking place in the community about the process and how it would take place. They didn't integrate all the schools at once. Initially, the high schools were integrated, and I believe it was in the year of 55 and 56 that they integrated the high school. Then followed that the 7th and 8th grade, and then ultimately all the classes. And I think it was about 1958, all schools in Liberty were integrated. And Cecilia said something very clearly, somewhat. One is that they did move with relatively deliberate speed, had meetings, prepared children and parents for going into these integrated situations. But they did not, the teachers, the African-American teachers at Garrison School, with the exception of one, were basically fired, were not issued new contracts. And as a result, they had to find other placements. And they did, and ended up being quite successful as we followed some of their stories. The one person that remained was the principal at Garrison School, C.E. Gant, who was quite a mathematician, who often tutored many college students at William Jewell College. C.E. Gant was kept on staff. It was unfortunate, though, he was not kept in a position due him. He had a master's degree in the 50s. But ended up being relegated to being a playground supervisor and a study hall personnel. So we did integrate. The situation really, let me share this with you too, and it's a sidebar but a great story. Olin Jones, a gentleman who was over the park board in Liberty at the time in the mid-50s, had this idea, and my assumption is that he borrowed the idea from Branch Rickey to integrate a Little League baseball. And I had the opportunity to start playing before the schools were integrated, playing on a Little League baseball team called Turner Tyson Ford, as a matter of fact. And I played on that team and got acquainted with many of my white peers. And so when the schools were integrated, on that first day going into school at this large school I was going into at the time, it's now called Ridgeview Elementary, I walked in this building. It was an awful big school compared to Garrison. And it sent me down the hall, and I went into Miss McCarty's room, and she welcomed me, and she looked at me and she said, "Albert, just have a seat wherever you're comfortable." And all I could see was a sea of white faces that I didn't know. And so I looked around and hesitated, and someone out of nowhere called my name and said, "Albert, sit by me." And it was a young man named Kent Brown that I had played baseball with. So here again was a positive situation that Olin Jones knew what he was doing to help prepare and begin to build relationships. And so that was my first day at Liberty Ridgeview School, where I was welcomed by a white counterpart, Kent Brown. And I just seen Kent Brown this past September after some almost 50 years to thank him for being there to welcome me.
Why don't more of us in the greater metropolitan area, let alone, I mean, the country, know that there are stories like these of communities where it sounds like things played out kind of differently than the other stories we hear.
Sometimes those stories are hard to capture. They're not as illuminating. They're not as possibly interesting. They're not as, you know, negativity sales. I mean, that's my observation. And I suspect these kind of experiences were taking places in various other parts of the country and world. I don't have a complete answer except we should spend more time focusing on them.
You know, Cecilia, I want to bring you in on this as a historian. I mean, talk to me a little bit about what does make it into our consciousness as history with a capital H and what doesn't.
Well, volunteer historian, okay? I believe that these stories are oral histories that have to be told by the persons who are yet living, who were a part of the era. And unless you have individuals who are around who can give you that information, because it has not always been recorded. African American history was not always recorded and written. And so there are stories, there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of stories that are still there. But you have to have someone who can go in and sit down and actually interview someone. Please tell me your story. What happened to you during this time? So until we can get people together and sit down and do oral histories, videotape them, record them, whatever, I think those stories are going to remain lost, or they won't be around.
AJ, for you, I mean, you told the story of your great-grandfather, how on the one hand he was a free man who bought land, who purchased the freedom of his wife, helped found a church in Liberty, but he also had to carry papers documenting his freedom. He had challenges that the situation of the time created for him. And for you, you talk about this peaceful integration of the schools in Liberty and in your own childhood. I wonder if there was a flip side for you as well.
Yes, there were instances. You know, if not directly to me, I was aware of. My own wife, who can tell the story much better than I could, as a second grader at a Franklin School in Liberty, she went into the second grade, and she said that the teacher isolated her, set her apart from the rest of her classmates, and clearly made it apparent that she was not welcome. And the students obviously responded to the teacher and followed her lead. Very clearly, my wife was, thank goodness she's a strong person, because that could have broke a person, break them down. But she survived that and went on to complete the second grade and complete her education and became quite successful. So every story wasn't good. One of the things that favored me, I'm convinced, is that I was athletic. I was involved in sports. I built a natural peer group, even you see from that baseball team. But I went on into school where I built those relationships, playing on sports teams. So I had this small group that I belonged to. There's an experience that I have, and it's unfortunate. I played ball also another year, a couple, 3 years down the road for what was the Clay County Sheriff's Department sponsored the team. Played, I was a pitcher. We had a successful season, and we were scheduled to go to the Hall of Waters in Excelsior Springs. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I had the opportunity to go there. That was our reward for having a successful season. I showed up at the baseball field where we were scheduled to meet and to drive to Excelsior. And the coach, who happened to be a lieutenant on the Sheriff's Patrol, informed me that he said, "Albert, didn't your mother tell you that you won't be able to go?" And I said, "No." He said, "So, anyhow," he said, "blacks can't swim, Negroes can't swim at the Hall of Waters." And I was very upset. I went home through the cemetery kicking rocks and angry. And I got home and I told my mother, and she said, "I want to tell you one thing, son." She said, "I want you to know this very clearly. You're just as good as anyone else." And that was so important for me to hear that from my mother, because I kept that all my life. I'm just as good as anybody else. And I continue to carry that as part of my life. And
is that part of what motivates you to share this piece of history?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just as good as you.
Our time is up, but AJ Bird, thank you so much. And Cecilia A. Robinson, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Two new murals in Liberty inspired our conversation about the African American community that's lived in Liberty and thrived there since at least 1843. You can listen back to this conversation as well as our chat with artist Rodolfo Marone at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that ready for you later today. And you can keep talking to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Koi Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.